President Obama spent the last week talking about his plans to improve America's infrastructure. Sometimes his speeches sound like something out of the Jetsons. He talks about high-speed rail, futuristic airports, nationwide broadband internet. But one growing part of America's infrastructure has a distinctly 19th century feel, and Pierre Zari Shapiro reports on the rebirth of the streetcar.
Outside the famous Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon, a 21st century streetcar glides to a stop, opens its doors, and lets out a mix of tourists and locals. Modern streetcars have been running in this city for about a decade. Chandra Brown lives right along their route.
I live in downtown Portland. I love the streetcar. And they had told me that there were no streetcars built in the United States. And I basically said that you're a liar. That can't be, honestly. And so I did some research after that and found out that, yes, that is absolutely correct. There was no builder of modern streetcars in the United States.
As it happens, Brown is a vice president of Oregon Ironworks. The company has been making bridges, boats, and other heavy equipment since the 1940s. A few years ago, they created a subsidiary called United Streetcar. Now they are manufacturing the first American-built streetcars in more than 50 years. The factory is a cavernous space in a Portland suburb where people are welding a nuclear project next to men with hammers constructing the base of a streetcar. 70% to 90% of the parts are made in the U.S. There are seats from Michigan, upholstery from North Carolina, windshield wipers from Connecticut.
Considering we just started and it was 2009 when we really finished the first prototype made in USA streetcar, and now this little fledgling company is building 13 cars with 50 million plus in orders.
In fact, the U.S. is in a streetcar boomlet. More than a dozen cities either have them or are actively planning for their development, says Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer.
You don't have to be a large metropolitan area to support it. Little Kenosha, Wisconsin has a streetcar. Little Rock has a streetcar.
I met Blumenauer in Washington, D.C. at a coffee shop on H Street Northeast. It's a gradually gentrifying neighborhood that is stage one in Washington's planned streetcar route.
What the skeptics, I think, forget is that virtually every American city was designed around a streetcar. I mean, the most ambitious plans for Washington, D.C. for streetcar are approximately one-fifth of what the district had 100 years ago.
Blumenauer was a champion of streetcars years before his state started manufacturing them. He says they're green, they last decades, and businesses are more likely to set up shop along a streetcar route because they know it won't move the way a bus line might.
So reintroducing the streetcar is actually back to the future, and this is what this community was about when it was coming together a century ago.
Critics of the streetcar boom worry that these expensive new routes may be going into places where they are not the most useful. Brian Taylor directs UCLA's Institute of Transportation Studies. He says governors, mayors, and taxpayers all want flashy new projects, but sometimes it's cheaper and more effective just to fix what's already there.
We're painting ourselves into a bizarre corner where we're not able to maintain our streets, where we're not able to maintain the buses and the trains we have out there, and we're focused on cutting ribbons in front of new rail projects.
So are you skeptical of the streetcar partisans who say this is the magic bullet?
Well, it's sort of like saying, are you skeptical of cardiologists that say that coronary artery bypass surgery is really the solution? Again, if the investment is tied in effectively to the rest of the transit system, it can be a very effective investment. If it's not, and there are cases where it has not been, then it's not.
On Monday, President Obama will unveil his new budget. He has already said it will call for rebuilding American infrastructure. That means more planes, trains, and automobiles, and perhaps also streetcars. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Blogg. The U.S. government announced its plans today for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The bottom line, it would like to see the mortgage giants phased out over the next 5 to 7 years. The pair had to be taken over by the government at the height of the financial crisis and have so far cost taxpayers more than $130 billion. But troubled as they are, Fannie and Freddie now dominate the nation's housing finance system. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, that makes eliminating them a difficult proposition.
When it comes to mortgage finance these days, the government is just about the only game in town. But Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says it shouldn't be that way.
We need to wind down Fannie and Freddie and substantially reduce the government's footprint in the housing market.
The Obama administration proposes doing this by, among other things, requiring borrowers to make bigger down payments and reducing the maximum amount of a Fannie or Freddie-backed loan. Here's how Karen Petru of Federal Financial Analytics describes it.
They're not being strangled. They're being asphyxiated slowly, gradually, and carefully.
This would open up space for the private sector, private capital, to come back into the market. But administration officials say that's going to take some time and that reformers need to be cautious as they proceed because the housing market is so weak. The plan released today is really more a set of ideas, possible paths, as Geithner joked at a Brookings Institution event earlier today.
The way we describe this is, you know, we're going to drive west. Everybody wants to go west. We sort of know where we're going to go, but somewhere around Salt Lake City, we'll make a choice about what mix of ultimate options.
The plan lays out three different levels of government involvement in the housing finance market and basically tosses Congress the task of deciding what to do. Under option one, the government gets out of the housing business, except for FHA, which would have a much more limited role. This is the largely privatized model that many conservatives have been calling for. Lots of people, including Petru, say consumers will pay if there's no government guarantee.
It would mean a lot fewer mortgages at considerably higher cost.
And the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage?
I think of the past.
Option two is what one administration official called the National Guard approach. Lori Goodman is a mortgage strategist at Amherst Securities.
Option two is, well, gee, we kind of like option one, but the problem is that the private market wasn't there when we needed them the most during the crisis. There was no credit availability from the private market.
So in times of crisis or recession, a government backstop would jump into place to make sure people can still get mortgages. Option three is the one that seems to have gained the most traction with various industry groups and think tank types. In this approach, private companies would guarantee the mortgages, and then, behind them, the government would be in place as a catastrophic reinsurer. Again, Karen Petru.
With the government standing far behind the private sector to create that level of protection that investors around the world demand to buy a mortgage-backed security.
The private companies and their shareholders would have to be totally wiped out before the government stepped in. Still, the Obama administration admits that under this approach, there's a chance that private firms could take on excessive risk, and taxpayers would once again be left with the bill. Lori Goodman says those in the mortgage industry are meeting this overall plan with its three options with a yawn.
I'm sure a lot of time and effort went into it and very little came out of it. And I think what it served to underscore is it's a lot easier to say the present system isn't working than to figure out what to do about it.
Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
The fate of Fannie and Freddie is not the only factor creating more uncertainty for the housing market. A growing number of experts are looking at the mortgage interest tax deduction. That's the tax break that puts money into the pockets of millions of homeowners. Getting rid of that break has been politically unthinkable. That may be changing, NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
A growing number of economists are telling Congress that the time has come to phase out this sacred tax break for homeowners. But don't tell that to anybody who works in real estate.
Get rid of the mortgage interest tax deduction would just kill the market.
Wendy Rocha is a realtor at a Century 21 office in Watertown, Massachusetts. She and the other realtors here do not like the idea, especially now with the housing market just barely starting to recover.
I think it would really put a damper on home ownership completely if it was removed.
Realtor Medea Palangian says she often explains to first-time homebuyers how they can deduct the interest that they pay on their mortgage.
Absolutely. I mean, specifically, I have one that was on the fence about rent versus own. And I said, speak with your mortgage person so you understand all the benefits and all the deductions that you get on top of it. But if that benefit was taken away, they could just make it all that much harder to buy.
But many economists are skeptical that the tax deduction really does promote home ownership. They say the home ownership rate in the U.S. is about the same as in Canada, Australia, or England, and those countries do not offer such a tax break. Also, they say it favors wealthier people who can write off loans on their primary residences and even on second homes up to $1 million.
The mortgage interest deduction, while many people gain from it, is not a wise use of our tax dollars at this point.
Ted Geyer is an economist and a former Treasury Department official. He says, here's the problem. The federal deficit is now more than $14 trillion. And many economists say the government at some point has to trim spending and raise more revenue to pay down that debt. And Geyer says that the mortgage tax break costs the government a ton of money.
This is a biggie. You know, the forecast for the next few years range from about $100 to $130 billion a year. So, you know, over a four-year period, you're probably around $500 billion.
A bipartisan federal commission looking for ways to balance the budget recently recommended ending the tax break. It would replace it with a less costly tax credit that would reach more lower-income Americans. It also suggested excluding mortgages that are larger than $500,000. But is anything like that actually politically feasible?
All we're trying to say is, well, look at what the cost is of doing this.
Jay Brinkman is chief economist with the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says the move would push down home prices, and his industry group will be lobbying very hard to save the tax break.
Not to mention people with mortgages who are taking the deduction who are more than capable of sending an email or a letter to their congressman saying, boy, I'd really like to try and keep that $300 or $400 a month.
Yeah, you get about 60 days of that. Don't worry about it. Just go out and look at stuff. Go fall in love with the property.
Back at the Century 21 office, mortgage advisor Jay Hughes is working the phone. He's hoping that nothing changes with the tax break. And he says it seems okay to him that a wealthy lawyer or doctor gets a tax write-off on, say, a ski house.
So he's buying a ski house. So that means he's buying ski passes. He's buying skis. He's buying, you know, snow removal guys. So he's putting those guys to work in around that area.
With the housing market still shaky, it's unlikely that the government would do anything to end the tax break right away. But it is one of the unpopular moves that lawmakers are starting to consider to get the federal deficit under control. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. February is when potential home sellers start painting walls beige and cleaning out closets, preparing for the spring home buying season. But sellers got some unnerving news this past week. The interest rate on a 30-year mortgage jumped to a level not seen since last April. In November, the average rate slipped to a 40-year low of 4.17%. Today, it's a little more than 5%, and concerns are growing that rates will keep rising, enough to scare away potential buyers. NPR's senior business editor Marilyn Giewax is with us. Welcome, Marilyn.
Hi, Annie.
So let's talk more about this. Interest rates were so low last year. Why do we think that they're moving up this year?
Everybody in the housing industry has been really hoping that these interest rates would stay very low for a very long time, or at least until the market bounced back. But unfortunately, what we've got today is home prices and sales are still depressed, but now the mortgage rates are ratcheting up. And the key reason for that is just inflation. In recent months, we've seen prices rising on all the commodities, steel and wheat, oil. And whenever prices go up, long-term interest rates, like those on a 30-year mortgage, they rise along with them.
So are these higher rates actually hurting home sales then?
So far, the rate hikes haven't really been steep enough to discourage potential buyers. 5%, still pretty low by historical standards. But mortgage experts generally say that when they start to get closer to 6%, it will undermine the housing market. But here's one encouraging thought for the people who might have their house on the market today. These rising rates, they can give a short-term boost to home sales by pushing a lot of potential buyers off the fence. People have been taking their time trying to make a decision. They want to make a commitment before these rates do go to that higher level.
But would it really even make sense to rush and buy a house and lock in today's interest rates, given that the home prices may still fall further?
There is a trade-off there. If you act now, maybe you're going to spare yourself from getting a 6 or a 7% mortgage rate in the future. But on the other hand, maybe you live in a city where housing prices are still falling, and maybe they're going to go down another 10% the way some economists think. This much we do know about right now. Today's combination of low mortgage rates and low home prices are making ownership more affordable than it has been in really a generation. Affordability refers to the ratio of home prices to annual household income. So another way that I could put that is, can the average worker afford to buy the average home. And during the bubble, that was the 2002 to 2007 period, home buying became really unaffordable. That's why people resorted to all those crazy loan ideas where they were getting interest-only mortgages. But today, people don't need those kinds of tricky loans to become homeowners. But what they do need is a good credit score.
Okay, how good is good?
Well, in the aftermath of that financial crisis, the lenders are still keeping their standards really high. So to get a good loan, you need a credit score of about 740 or higher.
So, I mean, based on what you've been saying about affordability, should renters rush to buy?
Not necessarily. Financial planners point out that while home buying is affordable now, so are rents. They're way down, too. And there's another thing. Renting allows you to have more mobility. If you get a good job opportunity in another location, it's easier to move if you're not tied down by a house. And there's one other factor to keep in mind. The political winds have been shifting. As lawmakers start to look for ways to balance the budget, they might decide to phase out some of those mortgage deductions. And also, this past week, President Obama proposed winding down the government's role in mortgage financing. So if you take all of those political changes together, it might make home ownership less attractive down the road, and that could make selling your house harder in coming decades.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giwax. Marilyn, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Adi.